Policy Genius is the country's leading online insurance marketplace. It can save you time and money so you provide your family with a financial safety net starting today. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius gives you unbiased advice from a licensed expert. They have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot from customers who have found the best fit for their needs. Policy Genius helps you compare your options from top companies and their teams of licensed experts. Talk to a team of award-winning agents who will walk you through the process step by step. Easily compare quotes from America's top insurers in just a few clicks to find your lowest price. Your work-life insurance policy might not be enough to protect your family's needs. Finding the right policy can be time-consuming and overwhelming. Let Policy Genius help you find the right policy and protect your family today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 18.
Altitude. Tower 26 is released to you. Runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5. Clear for takeoff.
Sea tide. Altitude 0 eyes. We're clear for takeoff. Clear for the airspace.
Fire projector. Low speed. Fire projector. Fire projector.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted area 6002 is still active.
Welcome to the podcast and thanks for listening. My guest today is retired Lieutenant Colonel John Huggins, known as Huggy. That might be the first time I've actually ever said his full name. I met him in 2018 when he was announcing the Hangar 24 Air Fest out in Redlands, California. I was flying it quite a good time. Huggy started flying the U-2 back in 1989, and he is actually still flying it today, which is impressive. We're going to talk about his aviation career and a little bit more in the podcast today. Before we get rolling, I would just like to say, again, thanks for listening. If you're enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe. Leave me a rating or review over on iTunes. That helps me out. And I'd like to talk about Wingman Watch, sponsored this episode. It's been awesome working with them for the past year. Veteran-owned, started by a fighter pilot. And it's cool to see all the designs they've been rolling out. I was just on wingmanwatch.com this morning, and they have a whole slew of groups that are building group custom watches right now. If you're a group, an organization, and you're thinking about building a watch, I encourage you to swing over to wingmanwatch.com. They'll take care of everything from start to finish. All you have to do is just provide an initial thought and idea, and they'll do it all for free. Swing over to wingmanwatch.com. You can mention my name and receive a discount on your group order. Or if you see a watch you already like, you can use the code RAIN10 and receive 10% off that order. All right, with that been knocked out, let's get into the podcast with Huggy. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Well, awesome. We'll get rolling into the podcast. Huggy, thanks for joining me. Excited to talk about your career, aviation, and just life in general with you. So thanks for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, good to be here. Thank you.
Well, as we get rolling into it, we give everyone just the elevator pitch of who Huggy is and kind of what a snapshot of your life looks like, because you got a lot. We're gonna unpack it.
Yeah, well, in a nutshell, I consider myself a Houstonian. Lived all over the place. 4 high schools in 4 years. Dad was an engineer, and mainly in the space program, but in radars, communication, and some classified government work too. So moved around East Coast, West Coast, but always back in Houston. I grew up right next door to NASA, the space program, Johnson Space Center. Lived about 2 miles down the street from there, and my classmates through elementary school and high school were people like with the last name of Armstrong and Borman and that kind of thing. So you know, you're 5, 6, 7 years old. You know, hey, what does your dad do? Oh, he works down the street. What does your dad do? Oh, he's an astronaut. Oh, great, let's go play kickball. You know, nobody cared.
That's
you know?
Wild.
And it was pretty neat to go back and actually go through the neighborhood and see the houses of some of the original Mercury astronauts down in the neighborhood and that kind of thing. But did that college at the University of Texas, where I was on the ROTC scholarship, commissioned out of there with a degree in computer science, and had orders for Columbus Air Force Base 9 months later, and I went on the told them I'd go on the moment's notice list. And a couple weeks before I got commissioned, they said, "We've got a slot in Del Rio, Texas." I said, "I'll take it." My parents are from Laredo and Cotulla. So some people didn't want to go to South Texas. Me, that was kind of back in my happy spot. I would go there and, you know, I'd be on the border for my youth, you know, during the summers with my grandparents. So I was happy to get to Del Rio. It was a wonderful place and the locals are wonderful people. So down to Del Rio and wanted nothing more than to go fly fighters. But they had different plans for me. I stayed there as a T-38 instructor. And so I still had the fighter dream going, and the fighter dream probably would have worked out for me, except for a couple of things. First of all, the big fighter drawdown in the 1988 time frame, where Air Force is going from 40 fighter wing concept, and it just began plummeting. It's a lot less fighters. And then two, it didn't help that I was probably the least favorite instructor of the squadron commander there. So I was always in trouble with the squadron commander, and it was gonna be the proverbial hauling rubber dog shit out of Hong Kong scenario for me. So I saw the writing on the wall, and one of the guys I knew, a tweet fade, John Roush, he told me about this thing called the U-2, and I said to him the same thing I've told people that have told me when I mentioned the U-2, they still fly those. And then, you know, mine, this is 32 years ago. He said, "Oh yeah, they're going like gangbusters." So John got hired, and long story short, he helped me build the application up, and I submitted the application and went out there actually interviewed with the first lieutenant, showed up there, and man, a lot of people looking at me with a hairy eyeball. "We got a lieutenant interviewing for the program. Are you kidding me?" This is back in the guy still coming out of Vietnam.
Yeah.
They were running the place. And I did the interview out there, was fortunately hired. The last person directly out of training to head over to England, to RAF Alconbury out near Cambridge. And 3.5 wonderful years flying the U-2 at Alconbury. No T-38 companion trainer, but flew the U-2 extensively out there, and really learned how to fly the aircraft in some very, very challenging weather and wind conditions, and some of the operational missions out there were very, very challenging for us. Wonderful tour, burned out a little bit on wearing the spacesuit, and when they closed my unit, we would have stayed there for just about ever, but they closed the unit, and I took orders to Randolph to fly the T-38 at Pitt. Again, great chance to jump back in the 38. I'd missed it for 4 years, teaching other pilots how to be instructors in the T-38. So these are pilots mainly coming out of fighters and bombers, and it was a great chance to get much better my instructional chops, especially with the T-38. Then to that, promoted to major, and back off to U-2 land. Flew that for back at Beale, mainly in the schoolhouse, teaching the new guys till about 2000. Actually, about December 99, where I got out and went to the airlines. And when was this? This would have been early to mid 01, about mid 01. I'm getting off the, I'm doing a flight. I'm in Chicago, stand by the gate, waiting for, you know, passes to get off. And I see a couple people got off the plane. I recognize them. They're Air Force folks I knew from Beale, some of the enlisted folks. Hey, how you doing? And then one of my very close buds, Dean Neely, who is actually coming back here to be a civilian U-2 pilot now, gets off the plane. And he goes, "Hey, Dean, how are you?" I go, "You know, hey, great to see you. Dean, where you been?" "I can't tell you. See ya." So I'm like, oh, man, I really missed this. So I went down and got the application stuff all set up with the Air Force to come back on active duty. And then talking to my wife about it. She's like, "No, you know, you made your bed." We'd left Beale, moved to San Antonio, Texas. We're living there. I'm living right outside the gate of Randolph Air Force Base. She's like, "No, I don't think it's a good idea." "No, come on, honey. This is great." "No, it's a horrible idea." Back and forth. But I went ahead and filled out the application, left it sitting on my desk. And then I went and flew a trip. And I went and flew that trip on September 10th, 2001. And then the next day we're leaving Kansas City on the way to Chicago. And I was airborne when 9/11 kind of went down.
Wow.
So stuck in Chicago for about 5 days. I was on the first flight back into San Antonio. Walked in there. I gave it another couple days to go over the application, let things cool down so I could get on to Randolph. And I literally hand-walked my application and took 10 minutes down the road into the Randolph Personnel Center. Put it on their desk, you know, probably around the 17th, 18th, 19th of September. And by November, there I was back in the Air Force, back going through T-38 pit to get requalified in the 38 prior to packing everything up and moving back to California.
Wow.
Yeah. And so back to California I went, back into being a schoolhouse guy, went over to the desert for Desert Storm 2 and was the commander of the U-2s over in Saudi Arabia for the early part of the war. And kind of, you know, made my bed out there. And it came... You want me to dive down about a couple minute path on this?
Well, let's talk about it, because I'm curious. There, we got to go back and dig into some of the early upbringing and things like that. But honestly, I didn't know. I'm curious about the deployment to Saudi and Iraq 2 or 3, whatever we're calling it.
Yeah.
Because I imagine that was a pretty interesting assignment.
Yeah, it was good. But the funny thing was, so you know, coming off of active duty, being an airline guy, and then coming back onto active duty, you know, a lot of places they would not let, you know, your career is pretty much over. You're going to be the, you know, perpetual, major forever. And,
yeah.
And you burned your bridge. That was not so in the U2 program. They're very receptive to me coming back. So they kind of put me on the track to try to get somewhere. And, but my records were kind of a mess, and through all complete faults of my own, some things that were done improperly. Long story short is I got passed over while I'm in the desert waiting for the war to kick off as the commander, as a major with a Lieutenant Colonel DO.
And you had, you had a 2-year break in service roughly. Like, so
yeah,
you're completely
about 20 months
completely yeah. out. Yeah. I can see this just going really well.
Yeah. so yeah, here we are getting ready to kick the war off. And, I remember the ops group commander retired as a 2-star, as an Eagle guy. He's sitting at the table. He's like, so you're a major and you're the commander and you're passed over and your DO is Lieutenant Colonel. Yes, sir. That's right. That's the way the U2 program works. He just shook his head and left.
No other platform. No, like nowhere else in the Air Force. Would that even like, yeah. Would that even come to light?
So then about 2006 timeframe, the Air Force came down and said, now if you're a major, we need to get people out 20 years and you're a dot. So my date ended up being, I had to retire because I was passed over in 2007. So about, I think it was March or April 2007, and I hadn't done anything for jobs or getting out. I just, it's going to work out. And about 3 weeks before I was forced to retire, the Air Force came down with a policy. You still had to get out if you were a major with 3 exceptions. Helicopter pilots, U2 pilots, and Roman Catholic priests, and I fit one of those categories, so I was extended out there. And then during this whole time, I had submitted some paperwork to the Air Force and said, "Yeah, I think you guys kind of made a mistake. You really should have promoted me. I'm a great guy, you know." And so
look at me.
And this paperwork's been stewing around, been roiling around, I'm sure, in the personnel hallways for a while. And shortly after this happened, I got a word. Hey, yeah, we're gonna continue the investigation on this. You do have some valid points. And about 4 or 5 months later, I was on leave at home, and General Jake Palumbo was the wing commander. He was a Viper guy. I don't know. He may have.
Yeah, he was the 9th Air Force commander when I was at Shaw in the beginning.
So General Palumbo gives me a call. Hello. Hey, Huggy. Yeah, Jake Palumbo here. Yes, sir. What can I do for you? Where are you? Well, sir, I'm at home. He goes, Huggy, you shouldn't be at home. You need to be at work. I said, well, sir, I'm on leave. It's okay. He goes, that's not an acceptable answer, Huggy. When a lieutenant colonel is called by the wing commander, he should be at work, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not. I go, Lieutenant Colonel. He goes, yeah, you got promoted. You pulled it off. So we ran down the next day and did a brief ceremony. So I went from being the most senior major on Beale Air Force Base to, I think, the most senior lieutenant colonel on Beale Air Force Base. Finished out my career there in 2010. They gave me an assignment to go a non-flying job over for a year remote. Talked to the wife. She's like, no way. So I 3-day opted the assignment, and which means I'm going to have to get out in 6 months. But I'm determined to figure out how to defeat this threat. Yeah. So working it, trying about 4 or 5 different avenues. Nothing was working out. But as I approached the deadline, I General Bob Otto was the wing commander. And I found out that the wing commander could request a 6-month extension. So I went to him and pled my case. Said, you know, it's to the benefit of the program. We're short of instructors. He signed the letter. We sent it to AFPC, and you know, they weren't supportive, but they're not going to tell a 1-star to pound sand. You know, so
right.
So I got my 6-month extension, which gave me a little bit more time. Then I come to find out that there's this thing called the voluntary retiree recall program. And I called the personnel center. I said, hey, I'm on active duty, but I'm retiring, you know, here, you know, in October. Can I apply for this program to come back on active duty? They said, we don't care what you're doing right now. Will you be retired by the end of the year? Yes, I will. Then you're eligible for the program. So I didn't tell anybody at AFPC what I was doing. Basically, one office in AFPC was forcing me to retire, and the other office in AFPC was hiring me back. So on October 29th, on a Friday, we went and had a quick ceremony in the bar. They retired me. On Monday, I came back, went through the processing with all the 18-year-olds on base. They even paid me $32 to drive back to reassess into the Air Force. I got 30-something bucks for my drive from home. Sat there, got my turned in my retiree ID card, which I'd had less than a week, got my new ID card, and went back to the same desk I was sitting at 3 days earlier.
That is the quintessential Air Force story. You know, left hand not talking to the right hand, but if you know how to work the system, like, it works.
You just got to be persistent. So I ended up doing that. I got another year extension and retired in 2014. And then after being gone 15 years, returned to the airlines. And I missed it right in there for about early 2011 to early 2012. I was yanked away from the U2 that I love, and I went over to the MC-12 program for a year. And after 13 months there, I was able to claw my way back into my happy spot in the U2. But that's pretty much the run from 85 until late 2014 for me, at least. That's where the first big chapter ends.
That's all I got. It was a great podcast. Thanks for joining the podcast. I like the black hole, the MC-12. I mean, if you're a Beal, that was the black hole. There was no escaping that, like the pool. But another discussion. Backing up to kind of the upbringing, living in Houston, I would imagine being surrounded by all those guys in NASA, was that kind of the push to go pursue something in aviation?
Yeah, I've been asked that a lot, and I think it had to be. And I would guess I thought about flying airplanes maybe the time I was 8 years old, starting around then. And but certainly being around that environment with so many of the astronaut kids, my dad working on the Apollo program, that was certainly a big part of it. And you know, even afterwards, when I got to college, I applied and got a job right across the street from NASA as a summer and Christmas co-op. I would go back and work for IBM right across the street. I was working on the space shuttle program we were doing programming, and I was an intern in there.
Yeah.
And it was a fantastic career. In fact, IBM made me a very lucrative offer coming out of college, but I'd had this dream for over, 12, 13 years that I wanted to go in the Air Force, and I turned it down to take the commission to go that route. But certainly the environment in Houston had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, that's pretty wild too. I think it's cool the fact that you're surrounded by that and then end up in the U2. Although, as you mentioned, you didn't know it was still flying around, so I imagine that wasn't a driver to go to the U2. But you know what's crazy? I had a squadron commander who was always joking about, he was flying up initial, beating the Soviets, while we were still in diapers. But the U2, as the walls coming down, it's still very Soviet-centric platform in the late 80s.
It was. In fact, when the mission, when I went over to RAF Falconbury, our mission was to put assets up there and monitor the fold the gap where the Russians are going to bring, 50,000 tanks across, and all the the army's going to be going head to head, and all of our fighter bases out there are going to be, doing the dirty nasty stuff in the air against the bad guys. And our job was there to protect the line, Czechoslovakia up through Germany. And that's what we did. We flew up and down the inner German border in Czechoslovakia. That was the meat and potatoes of our mission. Not the only mission we flew, but that was the bulk of it.
No kidding.
Yeah.
To me, that's just, it's wild to think about that plane was built, designed in the 50s, early 60s, still flying around the late 80s and still flying around today.
Yeah, it really isn't there. There's always been a push to get rid of the U2 by people that want the budget and the money. But ultimately, I'm thankful that the people that make the decisions look and see the capabilities that it has and it's got the ability to really, you can put new new sensors on the aircraft, new processors. You can really update the aircraft, not just the airframe, but what the aircraft actually does. And it takes a lot of payload, and it brings it up really high, and it gives you that ability to just be the guy on the highest mountain out there, looking and listening at everything. And hopefully we'll it'll go away one day. Every aircraft does, but
right.
we've got a lot of life left in us, really. We do.
Until I came to the Air Force, I would have had no idea that U2 was flying around in Iraq too, even. But I imagine that was a different mission set than you were doing in the late 80s.
It did, and that really really helped us grow a lot, because the early guys, when I got in the program, it was, get on the black line, fly the black line, it's been approved to the White House and the Pentagon, and you don't deviate. And now here we are in a scenario where we're looking at 40 aircraft pushing across, at a particular hack, and we've got 8 Vipers down there, an AWACS, maybe some EA-6 Prowlers. We've got a we've got 35 aircraft that are basically working on the U-2's timing and where we need to be. So it really made us, you know, we had never gone to mass breeze before. Why? We're the high altitude, you know, package commander. Oh, that's just me, you know. and now we've got 35 other aircraft that are there supporting us to keep us alive so we can do our mission in a fairly hostile area. So we did a lot of growing as a program, I think, over in the Middle East, as a result of those experiences, and we're reaping the benefit of that now. We've got some very, very smart, capable folks, and you know, we just got our first graduates out of weapons school, and so things are moving along pretty well in the U-2 from a tactical mindset.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny, Jack Madison. I don't know what his call sign is, but I think he was one of the first guys to go through U-2 WIC. We were roommates going through Pitt, so it's cool to see. But I mean, the plane's been around forever, and now this is the first time we're having weapons school graduate, weapons school for the U-2.
Yeah, it is. So the first three guys got patched back in December, and then two more, they stayed at Nellis, but we got two guys patched, one in the 99th Reconnaissance Squadron, one in my squadron, the 1st Reconnaissance Squadron, and we've got two more guys going through that will graduate in December. So, they come back and they talk about some of the things they're doing with the F-16s and the F-35s, and it's they are really stepping it up and taking it to the next level, and it's good for the entire CAF, but it's certainly good for the U-2 program.
What do those guys do down there? I mean, there's not a U-2 sitting at Nellis, right?
No, there's not. They will occasionally bring one down for some of the different exercises, but they're getting a lot of miles in the Southwest, going Vegas to Sacramento, so they'll come back out here, one of the instructors and a student, maybe a few more, but they'll fly the assets out of Beale. But we're so close to Nellis, we'll fly them out of here, go out to the Nellis range. They'll meet up with the simulated adversaries, Blue Air, Red Air, whoever, and do their thing. And it's again, I'm only getting a little bit of the debrief, but it's really exciting stuff.
I guess that's a good point, because we didn't quite highlight on the fact that you're back in the U-2 flying it again as a civilian. So we ended at your military career, but you're back in the U-2 flying it again, right?
I am flying. You want to talk about that right now? Or you want to wait?
I think, you know, we should highlight the fact that you're the first civilian to come back and fly the U-2, correct?
Well, it's sort of, but yes, but sort of. So I retired in 14, and my retirement ceremony, September 26, 2014. I remember telling everybody in attendance, I feel really good, but I just feel like something's, I feel like I'm going to be flying the airplane again. I don't know. So we've been talking about in the U-2 for many, many years, since the late 90s, about bringing guardsmen in, reservists in, contractors in, people to fly the aircraft. We have this ton of experience that lives locally, and they separate, retire, and they don't do anything. They don't even come back and drive the chase car. They don't come back and teach academics hardly. We have a great, we've spent millions of dollars on these folks, and we're not recapitalizing the investment.
Yeah, I guess I didn't even process. There's no reservists flying the U-2, which is pretty abnormal.
Actually, that changed just a few months ago, but there have been no reservists ever. We're like the only asset in the Air Force that did not have reservists flying.
Yeah, that's, I mean, like
U-2s, F-22s. I mean, all the top of the line stuff. But you know, why the U-2? We could never make it. We could never get it through leadership and make it work. But it's starting to. We're starting to crack that shell now.
Yeah, that's odd. I mean, because that's like the easy button.
Oh, absolutely.
So yeah, back now as a civilian flying the U-2. Sorry, I had to interrupt.
No. So retired at a year and a half as an executive director of an aviation nonprofit. And then I just gave up on that and went back to the airlines. And this all of a sudden I got a call. Found out back around the early about the first part of this year, they were seriously going to advertise for a civil service GS, you know, not contract, but you know, civil service. U-2 pilot. And what had happened, the squadron had two, the first reconnaissance squadron, the training squadron, had two military billets that they were not using. They were on the books, but they really weren't filling them. We could never get the manning up to where they wanted. So the commander, the guy who's the A9 now, and some other people conspired to go, hey, let's make this, you know, useful to the wing. They took those two slots, converted them to civilian slots. One of the slots was a full-time. The other slot, they split it into two part-time slots. So there was three positions in essence, two part-time and a full-time, and they opened the application up on USA Jobs, and lo and behold, three people applied. It worked out. So we've all been in the program a long time. Everybody knows each other. So a lot of the guys had thought about applying, but a lot of people decided they weren't going to go do it. But we did the interview process, and June 8th, I was the first of the three to come back. And here I am as a civil service U-2 pilot. In fact, I just finished my instructor check about a month ago, and I just flew my first student sortie just about a week and a half ago.
It's wild. There's no set path. That's the moral of the story. You know,
it's true. And, you know, be persistent, and you just never know. Even in the bureaucracy of the U.S. government and the U.S. military, some very, very unusual and cool things can happen. And, you know, if you got the right people there, and, you know, it was the right squadron commander, a guy named Colonel Hall was the right guy to lead the charge. But, yeah, it's very strange, but it's worked out very, very well.
What's it like teaching in the U-2?
it's really different. You know, when you come to the program, most of the time they'll tell you when you're interviewing, this is a program for aviators, people that really like to fly. And to be in the schoolhouse teaching, you're teaching a lot of basic, flying skills. But everybody that comes to the U-2 program knows how to fly, but they don't know how to fly the U-2. And teaching in the 1RS is different because you're teaching in the two-seaters. We have four of the two-seaters. And the rear cockpit is just abysmal. It's the worst layout you can imagine. You're trying to keep this person from dragging the wing, ground looping the aircraft on the runway, and you're fighting just to be able to get your shoulders in the back seat when they close the canopy up. So it's an ergonomic nightmare. It's basically you're flying a Piper Cub with a 17,000 pound thrust engine, and it's really a lot of fun. It really is a lot of fun. And, you know, nothing makes I think a lot of people in the Air Force say, hey, let's go ahead and go fly a pattern only sortie. Well, especially the fighter guys are like, oh, just shoot me.
Yeah.
You know, you want to go ahead and go kill stuff and blow things up and chase people down. And
I just threw up in my mouth when you said that. So, yeah.
But you know what? When you go out in the U-2 and fly it around the pattern, it's a challenge. It's a lot of fun. It's hard to fly it really, really well. And you just beat yourself up constantly trying to make yourself better flying the aircraft in the pattern. And it's really a lot of fun to go fly around the pattern, just like taking a Piper Cub around in the pattern at your local airport, but with a lot more thrust and a lot more implications if you don't do it right.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I've never flown a U-2, but buddies, obviously, like you who have flown it and tell me the stories, and then watching like the chase cars, what's going into landing that plane, I know it's a lot of work. So I can see, you know, pattern only sortie, you're going to get out there and go practice. But God, again, that just makes me cringe thinking about it.
We had a guy that came, he was a 38 FAPE, came to the U-2. And then after touring the U-2, he actually went to Vipers, was a DG out of Vipers, did that for a while at Shaw, came back, and he was a schoolhouse guy at Luke. And I ran into him years ago, and we were talking about flying the U-2. We were in the squadron bar at Luke there. And he said, you know, he goes, I was more comfortable in my first 40 minutes in the F-16 than I was on my Finney flight in the U-2. Because that plane, it just, you're never going to get comfortable in that aircraft.
And when you're flying at high altitude, I mean, you're like, I know it depends on weight and certain things like that, but you're 10 knots from stalling and 10 knots from like the high speed stall. I mean, you're flying on the edge, right?
Yeah. You know, the envelope's a little bigger than most people think, but you know, it's our cruise mock's about 6-7 knots before we kind of hit we don't want to go above speed. I mean, have people oversped and gone above it? Absolutely. Right. But you really don't want to get up there. Certain parts of the aircraft start to go supersonic, and you get a buzz and a buffet in the tail. And that's, you know, when the tail of your aircraft's buzzing and shaking on a plane that's designed to handle less than 2 G's, you know, it's probably not a good thing. You don't want to go there too long. So it's
hard pass as you're sitting in your spacesuit. God knows how high, and your tail is going to rip off. Hard pass.
It's at 3 a.m. over somewhere that over a big body of water where there's no moon, and you're just sitting on the instruments. And it's a different adventure. You know, I'm sure a lot of aircraft, you fly them and you don't really worry about, you know, getting out of the controllability envelope very quickly. But the U-2, even when you're on the autopilot, you know, you always got that, you got that hairy eyeball out there watching everything going on, because that plane will just turn around and bite you in a second. But it's a big challenge, and it's not for everyone, but for those that are doing it, it's a great time.
Yeah. Not like the Viper, you know, it's pretty forgiving. Just pull as hard as you can. And then, I don't know, it's, you're either going to go to sleep or it's going to give you that, you know, like it's binary. Yes, no, it's going to work. Not have to be a real pilot. So it's impressive. Do you do high altitude training in the two seater, or is it like just get them pattern proficient and then cut them loose?
No, actually, the way the syllabus works is 14 rides in the syllabus. The first six rides are in the two seater with your instructor, just flying There's flying instrument patterns, engine out patterns, no flap patterns, normal patterns, patterns without the guy making the call from the chase car, and getting proficiency in that. Your seventh ride is a solo, your initial solo in the aircraft, and we make a big ceremony out of that. You know, as we rightfully do, we've got a plaque of everybody that's ever soloed the aircraft in 65 years in the squadron, and you get soloed, and you know, one of the leadership from the squadron or the wing will come out there and slap your solo patch on, and usually everybody that's in the squadron will come out there and meet you on your landing, champagne, you know, that kind of thing. And then your eighth ride is your first high ride. You go up in the two-seater with your instructor, your first time in the suit. So there's a lot going on there because your first time you're taking the plane really above 5,000 feet. And there's a lot of things that happen in the climb and different checklists. And we have a 52,000-foot climb check, you know, and you transition from speed to Mach at that point. And they're learning how to, you know, check the functions of the spacesuit to make sure it's, you know, it's working right, and how to urinate in the suit, and how to eat in the suit. And they're only 4-hour flights or 4.5-hour flights. They're relatively short flights, but there's a lot of things we got to teach them in that short period of time. And it's a big day of prep the day before. And you know, the first time you put a spacesuit on, you know, it's, you know, what am I doing? You know, how do I even, you don't even know how to work in this thing. So there's certainly a level we have to get them up to before we can get them moving forward. They do that. I think they do another solo high flight, a couple low flights, and their check ride, their 14th flight is in the two seater with an evaluator, and go up and do mission tracks and threat avoidance, and, you know, give them scenarios. And I know when I gave some pretty unusual scenarios. And threw a lot at them, but I really enjoy giving the check right up there and throwing a lot of no notice things their way and see how they handle it. Yeah,
you sound like a fun evaluator.
I got a big picture though. I got a big picture.
Yeah,
make them feel humble and then pat them on the back. You know.
Yeah, just make them feel miserable for 4 hours. Land. I don't know how long it takes to take that spacesuit off. You probably have to sit there for an hour because the prep to get into the plane. And it used to have to breathe oxygen, right, for an hour or something. Now that's like a waiverable deal. But what's the prep like just getting out to the jet? I mean, that in itself is a complex process.
Yeah, so we pretty much start getting dressed about an hour 20, hour 25 prior, and into the underwear, put on your urine collection device, and then out there, and you've got three technicians out there helping you get in the suit, two of them doing it, and a supervisor making sure that everything is precise. You know, the suit is the kind of thing all it is a backup. If you lose pressurization, you know, it could be an ejection. If the canopy seal comes off, you just lose pressurization due to whatever engine failure, it's going to leak out. But the suit is there to keep you alive because it's 60,000 feet or above 63 in particular, which is Armstrong's line. The nitrogen will come out of your blood and you'll basically boil to death. So the suit is there to keep your body at 35,000 feet. So I've never had the suit save my life in the aircraft. It just sits on me and I've never lost pressurization.
What is the cockpit pressurized to? Are you sitting at 35,000 feet? What? Yeah.
For years and years and years and years, if you were at 70,000 feet, the cockpit would be about 29,000 feet, top of Mount Everest. Oh. And we had a lot of people getting decompression sickness, the bends and some other things. You know, the bends is pretty minor compared to a lot of some of the DCS decompression sicknesses you can get. So a number of years ago, probably about 8 or 9 years ago, they went through an effort with the single seaters in the fleet, and they changed some of the structure of the cockpit. They changed some of the valves and such. And now when you're at 70,000 feet, the cockpit altitude is about half of that, about 14.5 roughly. So significantly better. We're gonna see the DCS is almost going away, but they did not update. They did not spend the money on the two seaters. So if you fly the two seater. That's all we really do in the schoolhouse. Yeah. Fly high in the two seater. So we're still going to 29,000 feet in there, and that's okay. That's what I did for 20 plus years in the U-2. So getting to fly the low altitude the single seat went up high is just going to be a rarity, and if I get to do it ever, it's a bonus, but probably not very much.
Huggy, you're now the guy in the squadron who's the old dude, who when everyone's complaining, like, well, that's how we used to do it. Like, I got no fear.
I don't see a problem.
Yeah, I don't understand why you guys are all whining about this. 29,000 feet is no joke. That's what, I mean, I fly around the Viper at 45, 48, depending, you know, going cross country, which then the cockpit altitude is probably sitting somewhere around 17. Mm-hmm. But, I had one or two rapid decompressions. I was keenly aware when I was sitting in the 40s, you know, paying attention to everything.
Yeah, that's no joke. You know, that it'll do some bad things to your body, and And when we're a lightweight jet, you know, it'll take us 18, 19 minutes to get to 60,000 feet. And so your cabin pressure is, I mean, you're that thing's cabin altitude. It's rocketing up there.
Yeah.
When you're on a lightweight training load. So it's, you know, you can feel you can just feel everything in your body starting to bubble as you climb up, you know, all the gases trying to come out. And it's quite the ride. Obviously on a fully loaded mission jet, you're not jumping up to altitude like that, but nonetheless, it does. But when you're sitting up there for 8, 9, 10, 11 hours at high altitude, especially when it was 29,000 feet, you come back and you are tired. You are whooped.
How long would it take you to descend? I was saying, like, my rapid decompressions, the two I had, I was below 10,000 feet pretty quick, but I had that ability to roll and pull. You can't do that.
Yeah, we can't be the Viper split S right on yeah. down there. You know, we kind of lollygag our way down, but and there's concerns also with, you know, we can do an emergency descent where we're flying right on the red line coming down. I've done it a couple times when I was stupid when I was a captain just to try it, and I think I got down to below 10,000 feet and. I'd have to remember maybe 12, 13, 14 minutes, something like that. I don't remember what it was. It's been a long time. Our normal descent profile, just day in, day out, is about 35 to 40 minutes from altitude to on the ground. You know, again, you can certainly speed that up, but you know, when you're pushing up against the red line, you know, the planes, it's a fragile aircraft and you know, you don't want to put yourself in a worse situation. The interesting thing is if you lose the engine in the aircraft, let's say you're at 65,000 feet and the engine quits, it's going to take you close to an hour and a half to come down, to glide down. It's just
nothing but time,
you know. You know, pull out a cigarette, smoke a lucky, look at the chart, you know, see who's got the best per diem to divert to. And that was the joke when I was flying in England. I'm going to find out which offices, clubs are open and who's got the best per diem. And I'm going to divert there. I got plenty of time to figure it out. It's, you know, no drag. You can't put the drag out once the engine quits. Most of it's hydraulically actuated. So it's stuck. You'll emergency drop the gear at some point. But yeah, it's going to be 80 minutes, I think, is what the book says for to come down from altitude. Lots of time.
That's why a flame out pattern. I imagine the U2 is pretty interesting to fly.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. We have this discussion a lot, and I would personally change a lot with the flame out pattern. But for what we have right now, if you're over the runway at about 1,000 feet, you can do a 360 and land it. That's all you need.
So that's insane.
We shoot for a little bit more than that. Look, we build it up with about we like to hit it at 1,400 feet and give ourselves some buffer. But yeah, if I hit it 1,000 feet AGL, yeah, I should be able. There's no excuse for me not making it, especially with my experience level. I should be able to get it back on around and make it.
Yeah, you know, showing up at high key in the Viper about 10,000 feet, you know, you should be able to make it.
10,000, 1,000, yeah, somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, somewhere in there. You know, it's rough. You got a brick with no wings versus nothing but wings.
And you're probably flying that pattern at 200 plus knots. I don't know.
Yeah, usually. I mean, obviously, it all depends on weight. You know, high keys can be somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000 feet usually.
Yeah, yeah. We're 1,000 feet and about 90 knots.
90 knots. Yeah, you see that on the runway when the nose wheel touching down.
Yep, 90 knots. Yeah, we're touching down probably if you're lightweight, touching down in the 60s.
That's wild. Here's a question. So if you had a punch out in the U2 at altitude. So Viper seat, you're going to stay in the seat until about 14,000 feet, roughly, before you get man seat separation. You're just going to be riding, staring straight down at the ground. Is the seat similar in the U2?
Similar function. It's the same seat that was in the SR-71, and basically, I'm told, the same seat that was in the space shuttle. I guess the shuttle had a seat in it for the first four flights. But it's a Lockheed seat, I believe. And so, yeah, same thing. If you go out at altitude, you're going to be in the soup. You're going to ride in the... You're gonna be riding the seat down with a drogue shoe behind you. You're gonna be falling to the earth for a long time. You're falling in the seat, pull out War and Peace, read the book, and throw the book away, and then eventually get the seat man separation around 15,000 feet also, and then you'll get the opening.
Be that Max Baumgartner, the Red Bull guy who jumped out of the little capsule, just I don't know, screaming down to earth, supersonic for a while. Gosh, it's such a wild concept, and it's impressive to see that plane fly. That is for sure.
Yeah.
What, you know, looking back at obviously your storied career, you probably have more U2 time than most people, I would say. What has been the best part of flying that plane? Coolest mission?
I was really, I really, going through pilot training, really, really wanted to be nothing more than to be a fighter pilot. But, getting into the U2 and getting settled into that, I found that that was the perfect assignment, I think, for me. I love teaching. I love the basic teaching part of the aircraft. My first tour was purely operational out there on the road, but I learned a lot about flying it and just the difficulty, the stick and rudder stuff. I've really found that I really enjoy talking, teaching, and the stick and rudder stuff. I mean, the mission stuff is great too, but there's that aspect of just the flying of the aircraft I love. And you know, one of the things, and it's, I guess it's a bit of a cliche, but you hear it from everybody. And now that I'm back in the squadron, but one of the things I really love about it is the environment I work in, the people I work with. You know, it's an all volunteer program. Nobody gets forced to come to the U2. And when I ran the interview process, I told people that all the time. They'd come in, I said, hey, you know, it's different. It's cool. Shiny black aircraft, shiny black T-38 on the ramp. You're all excited. I would tell them, but think about this really carefully, because if you interview, you fly the airplane well, we hire you, and a year into this job, you go, I should have never done this. I said, you have made your own mess.
Yeah.
Nobody's forced you, held a gun to your head to come do this. So make sure it's what you want to do. So by and large, we've got folks that they really want to be here and they really enjoy it. And they, so to go back to your question, what do I love about it? I really love the people I work with in the U2 squadron. They're just wonderful people. I'm sure you saw the same thing in your Viper squadron. But I really do love the mission and the people and the focus we have on it. And it's just a great place to work and a great place to fly.
I think anywhere there's like a filter, and I think, you know, flying a fighter, there's usually a filter to get to that point. So most people who are there want to be there. Now there are people who get there and realize they don't, and that's always going to happen. But did you guys start doing the U2 flying interview as a way to filter guys out, to kind of expose them to this fact, or is it purely to see, does this guy have the left hand, right hand monkey?
Yeah,
skills?
It's a little bit. It's more of that, you know. That they started doing the interview process long before I got in. In fact, when they started the program originally, they would come to people that were, it was mainly F-84 and RF-84 pilots, and they would come to them and say, "We've got a program. You want to go to it? Yes or no?" No questions. No. Do you want to go? Yes or no. And so they were hand selected and that sort of thing. And over time, when they had a lot of mishaps, they started interviewing people, you know, for the program. And we've obviously morphed on that a little bit, but we want to make sure, especially nowadays, F-16 is a good example. C-17, fly by wire aircraft. The U-2 is, it's a very poorly designed aircraft from the standpoint of flight controls. And you know, we had a couple of guys go through test pilot school, and they tell us something called the Cooper-Harper scale. And they measure from 1 to 9, every quality of the aircraft, the rudder of usage, the cockpit visibility, da, 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 da. And they say the U-2 pretty much fails every category they've ever tested. They would never buy the U-2 again, ever. You just wouldn't do it. So when you take somebody who's me as a 38 FAPE, I came out and did my interview rides. I go back and watch the video. I'm surprised they ever hired me. Taking a pointy nose guy and teaching them how to stuff full rudder into the aircraft when you're 6 feet off the runway in a crosswind. And it's you've got to break habits you learned in other aircraft to fly this aircraft effectively and without damaging it. So that's the reason we have the interview process. It's to see how well they can dump their old habits and pick up the U2 habits, the necessary U2 skills, as well as we also want to see how they think, how they handle themselves, and all the usual things you would want from somebody that's going to be, yeah, spending the rest of their career in your unique program. But the flying skills is definitely a big part of the program. We only see them fly for, it's 3 sorties. It's about 7 hours of flying time. And we've certainly made mistakes. I'm sure we've told people, had we given them, in the middle of training, they would have suddenly taken off and been fantastic pilots, but we can only go on the snapshot that we see.
Yeah, no doubt. What's interesting too, is the fact that you guys have T-38s there, obviously proficiency trainers or, ability to get more air up underneath you because you can't fly the U-2 all the time. But those two planes, the U-2 and the T-38, other than ergonomics, I think cannot be further apart, right?
Yeah, they're completely different aircraft, which I think is kind of a blessing, actually. But one of the nice things about it, they're A model, the 38A model, so round dials. But that 38 requires a fairly fast scan.
Yeah.
And because we always say about the U-2, it's the fastest 90 knots you'll ever go. It's amazing to get in that aircraft and just find yourself getting behind, and we cruise at 160 knots indicated. That's it. In fact, we have the fifth ride in the syllabus. The students have already checked out in the T-38. They've probably been cross country in it. they're bombing all over the place, getting proficiency, you know, training, instrument training, nav training. They're getting good in the 38. And the fifth ride in the U2, we put them up there, and we leave the pattern. We actually go up to Chico, California, 60 miles away. So we take off. We climb to 17, 16.5. We head to Chico, and we're doing like 200 knots indicated. So we're doing two-thirds of the speed of the U2. But you would swear we were doing Mach 4 going out to Chico because they're all holding on to the tail, and they can't keep up. And it's like the plane just – it just crushes you the first time you try to – actually go somewhere with it. And here you are, you're good at doing it in the 38, but why can't you do it in the U2? I don't know. And I always joke that the ride's called BQ5. I always joke when the student goes to BQ5 when I brief them. I used to when I was active duty. Hey, we'll fly BQ5 today. You'll bust the ride, and then we're gonna refly the ride here in 3 days. And you know, it was a highly busted ride. And usually I end up busting the guys. I kind of joke about it, but yeah, they pretty much don't fly it very well the first time. So. It's funny, Rain, because again, you know, you're used to bombing around the place at 400 knots, but you put somebody in a U2 doing 180 knots and they can't do it the first time.
Well, you know, it's one of those things too. The fact that I know that BQ5, right? They've had five rides in it, but it's different environments. And every time you're changing, no matter who you are, every time you're changing environments, it takes a time. I cannot imagine putting that. If you put me in that spacesuit, I wouldn't even know how to get in the plane, you know, like,
yeah,
restricted visibility, movement, all those things are just crushing.
Yeah, and another thing we say, when you put the suit on, as soon as that helmet goes on and locks into place, your IQ drops 20 to 30 points.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, it's a game changer for the first few times. It really is.
We have to do one ride wearing the Kim gear in the Viper, which it depends on who your IP is and how far you have to go. Mine was start the jet and then you can take it off. But some guys will do the departure, which I think is the most insane thing in the world to do because you can't see anything. Like, mine was in the summertime in South Carolina. I barely got the jet started and they just had to rip that stuff off. I'm like, if we get canned, I mean, we're dead anyways. But, yeah. You know, neither here nor there. It's like, I'm going to kill myself on departure just flying this stupid gear. But I imagine it's like wearing a spacesuit.
Oh, it is. But, you know, at least we have the vent going into the spacesuit. So we're getting cooling through that. You have to have the cooling, but. No, at least with the Kim gear, yeah, you're out of luck on that.
Yeah, the other aspect too, going T-38 U2. You know, it's funny now. I flew a Super Cub a few weeks ago, so I haven't touched a rudder pedal in quite a while. But to go between the T-38, like you touch the rudders, you'll die. To the U2, you must use the rudders.
You don't have a choice.
Yeah, it's such a dichotomy there. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, very very different aircraft. You know, and it's really neat to go. You know, it doesn't happen very much, but some days you'll have the. You know, T-38 in the morning and a U2 in the afternoon or vice versa. And that's a pretty special day.
Yeah. Making good pilots. Well, as we kind of wrap up here, Huggy, I always like to ask guys, you know, if you found, you know, 15, 16 year old Huggy walking the streets of Houston, is there anything you would tell him to do differently? I mean, you're crushing it. And you're like, we had to like probably look at the records as far as who has spent more time in the U2, you know, or the longest time in the U2, you might be up there.
I'm probably doing pretty well. And we know there's a couple of guys that have been flying for a NASA and you're doing flight tests down at Palmdale that have had a lot of longevity in the U2, quite a bit, but doing the active duty side of it only. There's probably not too many, but you know, there's some guys that did the NASA thing for very, very many, many years.
That doesn't count. That's NASA. That's a different beast. I'm talking Air Force.
But what would I tell myself? You know, I there's not a whole lot. I would have told myself probably just to lighten up, relax, it'll all work out. You know, but just don't be not persistent. Continue to lean forward and be persistent. But yeah, don't worry about things so much. If you're persistent, you work hard, and you've got some goals, you'll do fine. I also would have told myself probably play a little less soccer, and I would learn to play the guitar instead. But no, it's I've asked myself many times, what would I change about my career? And you know, I think if I could have gone to fly the A-10 for 2 years, I'd probably give up 2 years ago just to go fly on the A-10 for 2 years. I think that would have been a hoot. But, you know, really, quite frankly, you know, there's just not much about it I would change. I fell into the U2 program, you know, after not getting my dream of going to fighters, and it couldn't have turned out any better.
And one thing we didn't even mention this entire time, you're also flying a 777. So, you got it all going on. Like, and that the persistent piece. Yeah, I think it ties back into like there's no set path, but it's like kind of the path that you make, and if you want something, you can go out there and do it. prime example, Huggy.
It's all available. You know, you just got it. You got to figure out how much you can do. And again, my wife says I'm trying to bite off more than I can chew. You most of the time, you know, between air shows and Patriots jet team and everything else. But you know, the U2 thing has been quite a blessing, and I'm very happy to be back into it.
Now, Huggy, I know they're happy to have you back in it, and the Air Force is better for it. So I want to thank you for everything you've done, our friendship, and thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Well, thanks, Rain. This is a lot of fun. I appreciate you you thinking of me, inviting me onto your podcast.
Thanks again for listening. Hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Be back in 2 weeks with another round.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at HereYouAreAZ.com.